Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. We've got a packed show for you today. We're going to be speaking to the folks from the Santa Fe Clubhouse, and we'll find out what that is in just a little while. And we're going to be speaking to Martha Egan, novelist, author of the new book, Coyota. Right now, it is Disability Awareness Month, and I'd like to welcome Ed Keller. He's from the Mayor's Committee on Disability, and I'd like to welcome John Block, and he's from the New Mexico Governor's Commission on Disability, and Lisa Bronowitz is Executive Director of Open Hands. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, Disability Awareness Month, as we were talking about before we went on the air, every month should be Disability Awareness Month. We've had you on the air several years in a row now, Ed Keller, around this time. Where is the city of Santa Fe right now? How is the Mayor's Commission on Disability doing? What kind of strides have you made?
Well, we're working on different things. One of the major things is accessible parking. And the state had put through an initiative to have the parking fees raised if somebody went to an accessible spot. And our
so somebody who didn't have disabled plaque on their rearview mirror, does that happen a lot?
It happens every day, and there's very few private lots that targets one of the ones that has somebody going around and traveling around looking for that to stop people from doing it. But most lots and downtown, people park all the time. They always say, you know, for a minute here, a minute there, or whatever, but they park, and this judge that we have, Ann Yeoman, is really enforcing it, and it's not less than $250 and not more than $500 for each offense.
So, for people who are disabled and are have the proper tag in their car and so on, are you getting complaints that they're having trouble finding parking spots?
All the time. A lot of times myself, I have a placard and I'll go up near where the placards are and find a space. But other times I'll need to use it because I won't be able to walk in. And it's a constant complaint. I get calls pretty much on a daily basis. Certain places like Second Street Studios that there's never anywhere to park or downtown. But just so people know, if you have a handicap placard, you can park in any of the City of Santa Fe lots. The one across from the Hotel St. Francis or the one across from the Lensic. And you can park there for free with your placard.
Very
or at meters that are not accessible. You can put your placard up.
What else is the Mayor's Commission working on?
We're working on a lot of things. There's a few years ago we were working on what is a transition plan that has to be handed in to the, I don't know which part of the national government, but it has to be handed in for each city. And it's to the Regulation Committee for the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so basically the people that are... it's a transition plan how to get the city more and more in gear and in line with the goals of the Americans with Disabilities Act.
So how much discretion does a city like Santa Fe, which has a historic downtown with zoning and all of that stuff, how much discretion does it have in making decisions about how to conform to the Americans with Disabilities Act?
Well, I think there's a problem with the Americans with Disabilities Act with the law itself. There's not a particular regulatory commission above it that you can appeal to, so you have to actually, you know, get a lawsuit going. If there's something that is an area where people fall on a general basis because the sidewalk is broken, they can contact the ADA coordinator for the city, which is Joe Lujan, and his number is in the book, and it's also constituent services they can talk to. But long range, if nothing happens, which a lot of times it'll be a slow wheel as far as anything happening, and they'll have to do a lawsuit. And lawsuits are the only way that the ADA is alive, that it continues.
Now, I mean, I would think that disabled citizens are some of the most vulnerable citizens. They have the wherewithal and the pro bono or lawyers or the money to bring those kinds of lawsuits.
Well, everybody I know that have a disability have only a very limited amount of energy. And so just a lot of times, you know, I'll go out and somebody will say, oh, you look great today. And I had been in for 3 days before that and just really it was a huge effort to get out. So it's a huge effort for somebody to bring a lawsuit, even if they have a lawyer that will be from legal aid or whatever, it takes a lot of effort. And
yeah, yeah.
It just would be better if things could just roll along. But there's always monetary and, you know, monetary constraints that are there. So the city only spends so much on rehab of buildings a year, our rehab of streets a year. But that's some of the money that we've directed. We got part of a grant from the city, and we've directed it to more curb cuts and fixing different areas.
How are we doing in downtown Santa Fe in terms of, for example, wheelchair accessibility?
Honestly, it's still pretty bad. There's a lot of places, a lot of buildings, and a lot of streets that are not accessible if you want to stay on the sidewalk. If you want to go into the road, you can go quite a few places. And we're working on getting a curb cut right opposite the entrance to the Palace of the Governors, because people can't get from each side. There's a curb cut on each side, and then there's all the native people under there with jewelry
selling,
and things.
Yeah.
And so there's no way to get into that museum.
Oh, heavens.
So that's something that we're working on with the Governor's Commission and other places.
John Block, you're Deputy Director of the Governor's Commission on Disability. What are the issues that you are taking on?
We're focusing on virtually three areas, transportation, housing, and employment for people with disabilities. We have one individual, Dee Martinez, out of our staff who does employment. And she's been working with a lot of the different state agencies in order to see what we can do to get more people employed with disabilities. Also, besides going out and asking other employers, you know, what are you doing with people with disabilities, we're also looking within the state and trying to get more people with disabilities working for the state.
What are some of the barriers to doing that right now?
Reasonable accommodations. I think it's a matter of getting some education out there in terms of letting people know that reasonable accommodations aren't going to cost an arm and a leg. Usually they're...
What do you mean by reasonable accommodations, for example?
Sometimes they may need a different keyboard. They may need some help in terms of looking at the screen. Sometimes it's just a matter of changing their work hours. I heard of one individual who had a brain injury that is a lot more effective in the day in the mornings rather than the afternoons, so they allowed him to change his work schedule from 6 to 3 as opposed to 8 to 5. Those type issues, and something like that really doesn't cost you anymore. But I think people are afraid of reasonable accommodations or when they hear it. However, if you think about it, the restaurant gave you reasonable accommodations by giving you a seat to sit in. People in wheelchairs take their own seats everywhere. They don't need that reasonable accommodations. The lights, you know, people get lights. That's a reasonable accommodation for the mass public. But people who are blind don't need that accommodations. So it's a matter of a mindset of, yes, it's better to have a good employee keep doing their work with a reasonable accommodation.
So a lot of what you're talking about is not so much providing ramps, because probably those things are already there in public buildings by law. Ed Keller's shaking his head. I was going to say, we'll get back to that, but attitudes.
Exactly. And information, letting people know, you know, disability culture. And a lot of it is common sense. And some people tend to be maybe a little afraid of someone with a disability.
What do you mean by disability culture?
You know, how to treat people with a disability. I know some people in wheelchairs, my former boss, for instance, people would come up and say, oh, you're so great, you know, to be able to go out and, you know, tap her on the head or something of that nature. And
so it's sort of inadvertently patronizing.
Exactly. Yeah. And people want to be treated as equals. And like Ed was talking about, parking spaces. People don't get a disability just to get the great parking space. They just want equal accessibility like everyone else has.
Let's talk about transportation. That's another area that you're working on.
Right. We had Anthony Allerede of our staff go into the city of Santa Fe in the buses, and he did 2 or 3 days of training with the bus drivers on how to anchor people with wheelchairs and how to properly place them in the buses. And we've had bus drivers that have come up and said, we love this training. We haven't had this before. This is great. There's certain items in the bus that they weren't aware of. So to train them properly, also, we did have some cultural awareness training with them so that, and they had, you know, some questions about, well, what about this? Or, you know, if a person with a disability gets rowdy in the bus, how do you treat them? And our answer is, you treat them like you treat anyone else. If someone else is rowdy, you know, you do certain things. If they're rowdy with a disability, the same things. But just knowing the culture and knowing the individuals.
We're talking to John Block of the New Mexico Governor's Commission on Disability and Ed Keller from the Mayor's Commission on Disability, and Lisa Bronowitz is the Executive Director of Open Hands. What does Open Hands do? I think probably a lot of people know the wonderful secondhand shops.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And we also have an adult day center. But on the home front, as far as disabilities are concerned, we provide ramps and we widen doorways and put in walker stairs so that people can access their homes. So we sort of take care of that home front for people so they can stay in their homes independently.
So if somebody, for example, has an injury, they're in a wheelchair and they can't get into their own house, you come in and actually build a little ramp for them?
Yes, we do. Custom. Any house. We have a great crew that goes out and does that. We get calls all the time. People are almost suddenly disabled or they've had an injury. And so we get called in, we go in and build the ramps and put in grab bars and anything else to help them stay
so
in their
house. Grab bars are things like that you would have in the shower,
yes,
to get in and out,
yes,
of the bathroom.
That's right.
So.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you identify the people who need it, or do they identify you?
They seem to identify us, and there's always a constant need for ramps. We'd love to get more funding from the government for doing some free ramps for people, but we do get a lot of funding from the D&E waiver program. That's the Disabled and Elderly program. And so they will approve ramps if people go to the state and get approved through that program.
So does Open Hands fund itself through the stores?
The store helps to offset some of the lack of funding that we've suffered over the last few years, yes, and because there's always a constant need. And there are some people who don't qualify for those programs, and so they call us and need the ramps and can't afford to pay for them.
So what kind of complaints and questions and just feedback do you get from the public whom you serve?
Just that the system doesn't work quickly enough for them. Sometimes it takes them up to a year to be approved through the D&E program, and that takes too long when they have to have access to their house. Their families, too, are also burdened with trying to get someone in and out of a house if they're in a wheelchair and not very mobile. So there are all those concerns, not just for the disabled person, but their whole family structure is affected by their disability. And when you're trying to lift a wet, heavy body into a bathtub, that's pretty scary. So we also do something called a tub cut, where you can cut out a section of the bathtub. It becomes a walk-in shower. And that is a lot easier for people as well. I'd also like to mention that we have a medical equipment loan bank. So if someone has a disability, especially if it's temporary, we can loan them walkers, wheelchairs, crutches, shower benches, so that, again, they're safe. And we also won an award this year from the National Council on Aging for our falls prevention work. We were identified as one of the 10 best practices in the country for our creative work in doing home safety assessments and then our work in home safety modifications.
So what are some of the things that people should know about preventing falls inside their houses?
Well, they can call us, first of all, for a free assessment, and we can go in and help them identify even some simple things like a throw rug that can be a hazard. And no one else thinks about it if they don't have a disability, but suddenly there it is, and it's something that can cause a fall. And there are so many either permanent injuries and, unfortunately, also deaths due to falls in aging Americans that we need to really be on top of falls prevention. So we can come in and do an assessment, take a look and see what's needed in terms of grab bars, ramps, any of that.
And so people can just call Open Hands.
Yes.
And in terms of the medical equipment loan bank, do you take donations from the public? Do you work with the hospitals? How do you get the equipment?
Mostly from the public, and we also do get some equipment eventually from time to time from the hospitals. But we've got we just plow it back into the community. It's all for free, and anyone can borrow it for a while and bring it back when they're done, and someone else will need it.
Ed Keller, you and I were talking yesterday about this concept which has been brought up of a barrier-free city. What would a barrier-free city look like?
Well, it's interesting because last year there was a resolution proposed by Karen Helgemeyer and supported by Patty Boucher at the City Council to make Santa Fe a barrier-free city. And that looks at all new construction being done, that it is universal design, that it could work for anybody, and that includes people with disabilities. So, ramps, having things on one level, if there's more than one level, having a way to get there, either a ramp or a elevator. And it continues, because if anybody walks around downtown, the city of Santa Fe is very charming. But if you look at it, the sidewalks are, a minefield, basically. They're up and down, and tree roots have gone across them. And so there's many things that we're working towards, developing a plan on downtown to rehab downtown, redo downtown.
So smooth sidewalks, lots of curb cuts.
Well, curb cuts, there's quite a few curb cuts. There's one by the cathedral right now that there's a curb cut on one side of the street, one side of Palace, and then there's nothing on the other side. So curb cuts that go someplace is one thing, and also just sidewalks that can be used. Or when we had this heavy snow last year, the people at City Hall really pitched in. The parks people went out, and if it's a huge snow, you can call City Hall or the Parks Division if you're stuck in your house and have a disability and need to, so snow could be a temporary disability, for example, as far as it could be a barrier for a certain amount of time.
When you, John Block, think about a barrier-free state, what do you think of?
Well, number one, having all buildings open to the public, accessible to everyone. And unfortunately, when plans are drawn, sometimes those things are left off. And I know architects are familiar with them, but they don't always include everything that's needed. So to be aware of the ADA requirements in terms of accessibility for the public, one thing that we're looking at in housing is trying to work with housing developments to make a universal design in the homes. If you think about it, with the baby boomers, people are aging these days. Also, people are bringing their parents into their homes. And if the developers on the drawing board would put together universal homes where maybe the doorways are a little wider, having a level entry, putting reinforced walls so that they can put grab bars, these are things that won't cost much of any at the onset. And as we age and need those items in the house, it's a lot easier, and I think the homes would be a lot more marketable.
It's sort of like doing passive solar. It doesn't cost you anything to think about it and to do it, and then once you do it, it makes a huge difference. And I think it also is worth bringing up that disability is something that everybody experiences to a greater or lesser extent at some time in their lives, whether they're injured, whether they're sick, whether they're aging, and so that this is not something for one discrete population. It's really for all of us.
That's right. Jim McLaren refers to it as still abled. We are still abled, some of us, but that doesn't mean that we'll always be able bodies.
Exactly.
Ed Keller, anything you would like to add before we go?
Well, I guess that, yesterday, Mayor Charlotte had asked me what a barrier-free city would look like, and it's not only physical access, it's also attitudinal, because a lot of times people are either patronized who have disabilities or ignored, and just so there's a lot of attitudinal work to be done also.
Well, how do you find that, how do you deal with that, John Block, in your work with the state?
We do a lot of trainings and let people know. One of the things that have come up lately is there's a lot of businesses who've not allowed service dogs or animals in with the patrons, and they've had a lot of problems, even though the ADA says that they're allowed no matter. So it's just training and letting the public know what's allowed by law, and, you know, that people with disabilities want to be have equal access like anyone else.
If somebody has a problem, let's say they have a service dog and it's not allowed in, or some other problem comes up where a disabled member of the public encounters a clear violation of the law, what's their recourse? Is there a number they can call?
Well, a lot of times they'll call us, and we are not a direct service. However, we point them in the right direction.
Yeah. And the Mayor's Committee, if they're in the city of Santa Fe, I'll give you, Joe Lujan has a, his web address is jllujan@santafenm.gov. And my number is 989-7126. And basically, we can, with calls, we can put people in a direction.
And all of you found that there have been significant improvements in attitude and just people's educational level about disability?
Yes.
Yes, I think through training and education, more and more it'll be improved.
Well, we look forward to talking about this more on this show as time goes by. I want to thank you all so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you
for having us.
John Block is from the New Mexico Governor's Commission on Disability, and Lisa Bronowitz is Executive Director of Open Hands, and Ed Keller is with the Mayor's Commission on Disability. And we're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Marina Covey. She is Executive Director of the Santa Fe Clubhouse. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Now, we just were talking about Disability Awareness Month, and this is another kind of awareness that you are bringing to Santa Fe with your new organization. Tell us about Santa Fe Clubhouse.
Well, Santa Fe Clubhouse is, of course, brand new to Santa Fe, but it is actually based on an international model of psychosocial rehabilitation. Internationally successful. It's around the world.
And so what are you actually doing? What is your mission?
Well, our mission is to help folks with mental illness reintegrate back into their communities through meaningful work, paid employment, reconnecting with their communities.
And so that's a job that I think, I mean, we were talking about disability awareness, people with wheelchairs, people with other kinds of disabilities. Mental illness is yet another barrier that I think people have, you know, gee, would I want to hire somebody with a mental illness?
Right, right. It's very much the largest barrier people face with mental illness is the stigma in the community, stigma within themselves. You know, you don't realize how much it impacts you until you try to get to know your community again or try to get a job.
So when you talk about try to get to know your community again, what are some of the typical scenarios of people who work with your organization? In other words, somebody was fine, then they are diagnosed with mental illness, they're in a hospital, then they get out? Or what are we talking about?
Well, we work with a number of different individuals in a lot of different scenarios. We have individuals that have been hospitalized for a majority of their adult lives. We have individuals who have never been hospitalized but always sought treatment. We have people that never knew they had a mental illness and were unemployed and homeless, and through trying to find housing, were diagnosed and are seeking treatment, are trying to really work their way through recovery and get better.
What are some of the mental illnesses of the people with whom you work?
Well, a wide range, anywhere from depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, anxiety, schizoaffective disorder, really a range of folks. I couldn't say what the typical people that we work with. It just doesn't exist.
And so you are working with people and then working with employers to try to get people steady, solid employment. Let's say I'm an employer. Why would I want to hire somebody with bipolar disorder or anxiety or depression over somebody who didn't have those illnesses?
Well, we're really focusing on giving people a hand up. When you don't have recent employment history, maybe you've never worked, or maybe it's been 15 years since you've worked, chances of you actually being able to walk in and get a job are pretty slim. So what we do is we try to help people build recent verifiable employment history so that eventually they can get a job, walk into any employer and be involved in competitive employment.
So what are some examples of that?
Well, the primary example that's very, it's very specific to Clubhouse is called transitional employment, and it's a very supported employment. We work with local employers, and we find an entry-level job that they give to us as the Clubhouse. Staff members then come in and work for that employer at no cost. We train on that position until we know it well enough to train anybody. Then we select Clubhouse member, to come in and work in that position. At that point, they become...
A member being somebody who's...
A member,
who's
a participant in
recovering.
The program. Yes. From that point, they become that employer's employee. We train on that position, train that member until they're ready for us to step out, until when the employer agrees, we agree, and that member agrees that they are confident that they can perform the position. From that point on, that is that member's job, but the Clubhouse guarantees 100% absence coverage. So if that member is sick or has an appointment, we step in and we cover that position, again, at no charge to the employer. So the employer is guaranteed that their job is always done. They're guaranteed that as long as we keep that position, you know, they train us that first time, and unless the position changes significantly, they never train anybody again. So it really turns into a win-win. That employer never has to rehire or advertise, retrain for the job. It's always
No turnover.
Well, there is turnover. There's turnover every 6 to 9 months. Another member may move in, will move into that position. And at that time, we start that process all over again.
Right.
Again, we come in, we train them, they do the position. The only thing the employer needs to do is any necessary employment paperwork.
So what types of employment positions are suitable for this kind of thing?
Anything. Clerical, janitorial, food services, labor positions. Really, we try to put a strong emphasis on clerical and administrative type positions because we really need that experience. A lot of the work that we do in the Clubhouse is clerical and administrative based. So people really need that opportunity to get into the real world and get that experience.
We're talking to Marina Covey, Executive Director of Santa Fe Clubhouse. When you talk about mental illness, in other words, let's say you have a physical illness, you recover from it and you're better.
Mm-hmm.
Mental illness, is there a path to recovery, or is this something that you're basically talking about lifelong management?
Right. And lifelong management, but really a definition of recovery is doing what you want, making the most out of your life, achieving the most that you can despite your symptoms.
Now, there have been some real improvements in drugs. The drugs are available for people. So people with certain mental illnesses are not just doped up anymore.
Right. And that's been a very big change, especially in the Clubhouse world. This program's been around for almost 60 years.
Is that right?
It has. And when it was originally started, there were those drugs that everybody felt drugged up, and so that's what the population that we were working with. And now, with the advances in medication and the lesser side effects, less noticeable side effects, people are much more apt to enter that workforce because they're ready. They're not dealing with all of the symptoms and side effects.
How do you go about recruiting potential employers for your clients?
Well, that's pretty difficult because it is a win-win, but there's still that stigma out there. People, you know, say, we work with people with a mental illness. There's that fear that something's going to happen, that, you know, all we hear in the tabloids and in the news is violence, you know, when somebody with a mental illness, but what we're not hearing is, you know, all of the other people. The potential for violence is no greater than in the general population, but that's not what we hear.
Yeah.
We hear about an unmedicated schizophrenic that did...
Goes postal.
Right, exactly. But in the situation that when we work with people, we're working with them every day. And we know them very well before we put them into a position. We have a relationship with them. we maintain that relationship with them during that employment piece. So we're going to notice something far sooner than an employer would notice it. You're not going to say, boy, all of a sudden Sally was fine, and then 5 minutes later she was going berserk. That's not going to happen. That doesn't happen. And so we're going to see some symptoms. We're going to see some signs if somebody starts to have a difficult time much sooner than an employer would ever see one, and gives us plenty of time to intervene, to make sure that they're getting the appropriate services, make sure that any medications can be adjusted, things like that.
Now, the Santa Fe Clubhouse is not a live-in facility?
No, it is not.
And so people, what do? They show up. I mean, you have an actual building.
We have an actual building. We're at 1300 Louisa Street.
It's right around the corner.
Right around the corner. And it's completely voluntary, which is, you know, we don't dictate how many hours somebody comes a week. We don't dictate that they have to come to work. It's completely voluntary, and we need the participants to get the work done. Program participants are involved in all of the work of the clubhouse. Members and staff work side by side in everything from administration, hiring, training, evaluation of staff and program effectiveness, to janitorial, food services, clerical, research.
So the work that people are going to be doing out in the community, they do
exactly
at the clubhouse to begin
exactly
with.
Exactly. And then, so it's not live-in, it's not mandatory, it's completely voluntary. People come and go as they wish, but as people start to feel an increase in self-esteem, they're a part of something, they're really a part of our community, they begin to come more often, they stay longer. Pretty soon you see see an individual that walked through the door and said, don't even talk to me about employment, I will never work again, sitting in your office saying, the next job that comes open, I want that.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Where were you doing this work before you came to Santa Fe?
I was doing this work in Washington State, again as the executive director of the same program.
And how did you decide to come to this wonderful city?
Well, I had an opportunity to move in to Santa Fe and start a new program. I had started a program in Washington State, but there were some funding law changes, and so the program wasn't going to be doing well, and I thought that the best thing that I could do at that point was to find another program to start and get going.
We've got just a moment left. What would you like to tell our public about this whole issue of stigma for people with mental illnesses?
I would just like to say that there's not too many people that aren't impacted by mental illness. There's not somebody that you don't know. You know, one in four people has mental illness or will be affected by it. So chances are somebody you know has it and you may not know. You can't always look at somebody and know. But that this is a disability group, one of the most underserved disability groups, that really that is actually more likely than any other disability group to return to employment and become a contributing part of the community. This is a disability group that really needs a chance.
And as we talked about in the last segment, we are always on a continuum between our own ability and disability as we age, as we're injured. The same is probably true for mental illness as well. People suffer from depression at certain times in their lives,
exactly,
and not others.
Right. And this is a lifelong support system that they build in the clubhouse. It doesn't mean that they participate in it for their entire life. It means that they may need us now, we may put them to work, and they may decide that they don't need the clubhouse right now, but 10 years from now, they do. They have another bout of depression, they have something go wrong in their lives, we're still there. They don't have to requalify, it's not based on benefits, nothing. They walk in the door and we say, we're glad to have you back.
Marina Covey is executive director of Santa Fe Clubhouse. Now, you have an event for the public coming up, is that right?
We do, actually. Today, from noon to 6, we have an open house, and that is really just an opportunity for anyone that may be interested in membership, may know someone with a mental illness that they could refer to the program. Any providers may want to come in and take a look at the program, see where we're at, see that it's a safe place, ask questions, get information. So that's today from noon to 6. And then Thursday...
And what's the address?
I'm sorry, 1300 Louisa Street, Suite 1. And then Thursday from 3:30 to 8:30, we're having a grand opening and fundraiser. We'll have guided tours ongoing throughout. A lot of information will be presented, but then we have specific presentations that will take place at 4:30 and 8:30. And really, that's an event where you can come when you can, leave when you need to.
And what is the phone number and or website if people want more information?
The phone number is 986-9136. And our website is not up and going yet. Eventually, it will be santafeclubhouse.org.
Well, Marina Covey, thank you so much for being with us here.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Martha Egan. Stay tuned to KSFR.
Okay.
Here we go. We are on the air. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce Martha Egan. She's a novelist, and her latest book is called Coyota, which is published by Papalote Press, and she will be speaking tonight at Collected Works Bookstore at 5:30. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Now, this is your second novel.
Yes.
And there's some tie-in with your first novel.
Yes.
both have characters in them who are working in this crazy world of importing stuff from Latin America, which is what you do.
Yes.
One of the things that you do.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about Coyota, which is not only the animal, but the name of the nickname of your main character.
Yes. In New Mexico, Coyota can be, of course, a female coyote. It can mean other things, but in a very old meaning, it is a person of mixed background. And my main character is the daughter of a Mexican woman, and she's also got Apache and Irish in her background. It's also a nickname for the youngest in a family, and that's what her family has traditionally called her, is Coyota.
And so this is a very appealing character who is importing things from South America, and she gets caught up in this conflict between the customs people whom she has to deal with all the time and this whole issue of drug trafficking.
Yes. Well, she has a small flea market business in addition to her main job, which is teaching Spanish part-time at the University of New Mexico. She's probably late 20s, early 30s. And one day she's sitting out at the airport sewing labels into sweaters, which is a job that I did many times. And she hears a couple of people talking behind a closed door. And the door opens, and she hears a strange conversation and kind of can't figure out what they're talking about. The door opens, and she sees two DEA guys. And the DEA guys see her, and they know that she has overheard their conversation. And she later figures out that what she has heard was their conspiracy to deliberately down a single-engine plane piloted by a young man who was a student of hers. And the chase is on.
And bad people start following her.
Yes.
Now, what form would you call this? A thriller or mystery?
I think it's both. The book starts with a very bizarre dream that Coyota has. Her name is Nina. And it's a violent crash at a barranca, a canyon in Mexico, and she can't quite figure out what this violent dream is all about. And so it sort of presages what happens eventually in the book. So I guess it's a thriller. I guess it's a mystery. Who's in the car? What's that all about? It's fast-paced. It's only 173 pages. Some people read it in one sitting.
Like me.
Great!
We're talking to Martha Egan. As I was reading it, I was thinking, when you're working with genre fiction, on one hand, you have to follow certain formulas, and on the other hand, you have to be careful. I mean, the bad guy has an ugly scar on his face.
Oh, I suppose I overdraw things a little bit, but it's, you know, it's a way of marking him and picking him out of a crowd.
There's also, of course, the good boyfriend, bad boyfriend, and you certainly give a really lousy portrait to the New England WASP young man who at the beginning seems to be very fond of our heroine.
Well, Nina and her boyfriend, he's her new boyfriend, and he teaches at the university also, and they decide to go on this trip into Mexico. And Nina can't really believe that the DEA guys are going to bother them, but indeed they do, and they follow them. And as she's traveling with Cal, her boyfriend, she realizes that he's disinterested in the Mexico that she knows well and wants to show him. So there's a lot of discussion about Anglo versus Mexican culture and ways of driving and food and things like that. And I guess I did have a little bit of fun.
I felt like that poor guy, you gave him about as hard a time as you can give a character in fiction.
Oh, yeah, but it's fun. It's all in fun.
Now, so there's, you know, nice scenes in Guanajuato and San Miguel de Allende and other places in Mexico, and the book takes place in Albuquerque. But I was wondering in this conflict, I mean, it's fiction, it's a novel, but how realistic are these types of situations where somebody who just happens to be nearby finds out something they shouldn't know and is actually gone after not by criminals but by the government itself?
Well, if you've read my first book, Clearing Customs, you know that it's probably based on true experience, personal experience. And
certainly that was very clear, and we talked about that when we were on the air talking about it. Well, what about this one?
This one is, of course, you know, every writer writes from experience, and I have unfortunately had experience with bad federal cops picking on me. And picking on other people who were perfectly innocent, and to some extent, just because they could. I think the war on drugs, and now the war on terrorism, and the war on whatever it is this week, has really had the unfortunate consequence of federal agents picking on people who do not deserve it. And this is my tiny little voice, and my raising my hand saying, I think we all need to pay a lot of attention to the fact that there are abuses of power. We're seeing them every single day, and this is my little protest about those excesses.
Well, one of the things which is striking is that at a certain point early in the book, our heroine's house is broken into. Nothing is taken. And she is perplexed, but she understands that it's probably related to this airport incident, and she doesn't go to the authorities.
Well, how could she go to the authorities? It looks like it's the authorities who did the break-in, and I have been in that very predicament. And you don't know who you can turn to, and in this case, she turns to her older brother, and he tries to help her figure out what she can do and how she can protect herself.
The book is called Coyota. It's a novel by Martha Egan, and Martha will be tonight at the Collected Works bookstore at 5:30 in the evening speaking and signing books. Could you tell us about the particular incident in your life where you were in a similar position?
Well, I had been out of town on a river trip and came home to find that my house had been vandalized. And because I was being pretty badly harassed by the U.S. Customs Service or their delegates, I don't know, who were coming into my store on a daily basis, accusing me of being a pre-Columbian art smuggler and opening my mail, opening my packages, opening packages that were locked in my car. And, I know the feeling. It's really bizarre. And I don't know. I guess, like all writers, I write from experience. I'm relating what that feels like.
In your particular case, they were accusing you of something which wasn't true. Were they genuinely suspicious of you, or were they trying to hassle you for something different?
I think what they were basically trying to hassle me for was complaining to customs about their to customs authorities and also my political representatives about customs deliberately damaging my import shipments. And I very quickly got myself on a blacklist and got hassled pretty badly everywhere I went. And there never was any question. Any competent investigator would have known in 2 seconds that there is nothing factual, that there's nothing that they could be actually after me for. I'm not involved in criminal activity. It's not my thing. Writing books about it is, though.
Was your particular situation ever properly resolved?
No. Because, of course, you know, if somebody has been tapping your phone or deliberately opening your mail when it comes to a P.O. box, I mean, you'll never know that. You only know by the circumstantial evidence of slit envelopes.
What are the books and who are the novelists whom you most admire and who serve as models for your own writing?
I really admire a whole host of authors. Of course, I really love people like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who knows how to write humor and wackiness. I love people who can really describe things well, and in my writing I try to describe the natural world, which is very important to me. And, of course, there are any number of writers who do a beautiful job of that. For me, humor is really, really important. Sherman Alexie is one of my favorites. he can write about serious things but also make you laugh. And in my books, what I'm trying to do is basically entertain people and not hit them over the head with things, but also, you know, make it fun to read. You know, we all have very little time. We live in a very chaotic, sometimes violent world, and my aim is to entertain people.
What's up next for you? Are you going to keep on writing novels?
What's next for me, I hope, is to publish a collection of short stories about New Mexico. To date, there are about five of them. I hope we can bring that out in 2008. And they're funny stories about, you know, the wonderful, delightful aspects of New Mexico and also our own particular wackiness. One story is about a couple in the late 60s in northern New Mexico with car trouble.
Yeah. It's funny already.
It is funny already.
Now, are you still in the import business?
I am. I mean,
where is your? Do you have a store in?
I have a store on Canyon Road, Pachamama. This is our 34th year in business, and I do a little bit of importing from Latin America, not too much. I have to, you know, my shipments are still subject to very serious.
Scrutiny.
Inspection, shall we call it. And they get hassled. My shipments get hassled in Peru as well as here. So I don't want to overly burden the people who are helping me get my things here. But I also think what I'm doing, mainly supporting women's groups with the products that we import, I don't want them to be hassled on my behalf. And that has happened.
Martha Egan is the author of Coyota, a novel, and she'll be speaking tonight at Collected Works Books at 5:30, and that's right on San Francisco Street, across the street from the Lenzic Theater. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's been fun.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. And if there's anything that you miss, like a phone number, you can actually just go to the podcast, which is usually up within a few hours of the end of the show, or you can write to me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. And after all that, the Jazz Hoedown. Tomorrow, we will be featuring the great journalist and historian Juan Cole, who will be in Santa Fe, speaking on Friday at the College of Santa Fe's Beyond the Lecture Series. And tomorrow we will have him on for the whole program. So keep your radio dial tuned to KSFR. KSFR.org, 90.7 FM, 101.1 FM, and we will see you tomorrow. Ciao.